because the German plane was faster, how would you compensate for that with flying tactics? Or
well, if you're in the Spitfire, you just can't do much about it. I mean, you can just pull away and he's out of sight before you know it. Mm-hmm. But if you got into a really big dogfight, as they used to call it, you'd be flying with your squadron, and there's 12 aircraft in the squadron. Mm-hmm. And then you usually have three or four squadrons all going off on the same mission. So you might have as many as, let's say, 10 squadrons. And 10 squadrons times 12 would be 120 airplanes. Mm-hmm. So you could get that many. We've got many times we'd get into that situation where we had anywhere from 8 to 12 to 15 squadrons. Mm-hmm. And some would be flying higher than the others because each type of aircraft had its good and its bad points. Mm-hmm. And the Spitfire was able to get up to the high altitudes without any difficulty. And the 109s and 190s could do the same thing. But again, I would come back to say that the 190 could pull away if it wanted to get out of there.
You mentioned dogfights. How many were you in? Or were you in?
Oh, lots of them.
And what was that like tactically? Or?
Well, we were using the benefits of radar. And back in England, while we were crossing the Channel and flying into France or into Belgium or Holland or Germany itself, when we were across there, the radar people in England were keeping us posted as to what they saw in the sky. They'd see a gaggle of aircraft somewhere, and they realized that they were enemy. So they would report that to us, and we would then get sent on a track that would take us to intercept these German fighters. And then get into a dogfight with them. The idea was to knock down as many of the German aircraft as you could.
It's my understanding that the role of the Spitfire and tactical air power is to protect other missions that are occurring.
Well, we did a lot of escort work, mm-hmm. if that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
A lot of escort work, large formations of American bombers. You could be there. There was a twin-engine American bomber called a Marauder, and I can recall on a couple of occasions where we went out and we flew escort to these Marauders who were going into Germany to bomb. Mm-hmm. They were bombers, not fighters, and there was 96 of them. Mm-hmm. You can imagine 96
yeah.
aircraft in a formation. Flying across the Channel to drop bombs in Germany, and we would be up there with them. We'd be flying around on either side of them or behind them or above them. We'd have positions so that we could intercept any German fighters that came in to try to knock down these bombers. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened when I bailed out in the Channel on my first mission. I got hit by flak, not by German fighters, but by ground anti-aircraft fire.
Mm-hmm. It's also my understanding that because of your escort duties, you'd have a lot of low-flying
yep.
missions, which obviously could be dangerous because of the terrain there. How did you handle flying such low altitudes?
Well, you had to be damn careful. It was the most dangerous of the missions that we were on. I mean, the dogfights were something that you could orchestrate, you could plan, you could sort of have tactics that would outsmart the enemy, mm-hmm. and hopefully. On the other hand, if you're down attacking tanks and armored vehicles or in any radar sites or anything like that, if you were attacking those down low, right over the treetops, you'd be flying, and you'd go in and you'd have a target, and you would fire your guns and do as much damage as you can. We had cannons, 20 millimeter cannons and machine guns. So we had a pretty good amount of firepower. Yeah. But they were very dangerous missions, there's no question about it, because there is the danger of hitting something in the air. Your attention is drawn to over here watching a fighter coming in or something like that. In the meantime, there's a television tower or something in front of you, and you don't see it, and you fly right into it. Mm-hmm. Ball game over.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that difficult to stay focused when you were...
No, well, there were distractions, you could say. There were distractions which made it risky. Mm-hmm. But if you could carry on the attack and do a lot of damage, then it was worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that you were shot down into the forest in Germany.
That's about the second time, yeah.
Second time. Yeah. How long were you? Was anyone else shot down, or were you by yourself? Or?
No, I was by myself. Of course, in the Spitfire, there's only one person. There's no crew member. So, when your aircraft goes down, you go down with it. That's it. On the other hand, I was lucky in a way. I got hit by anti-aircraft fire, and my cockpit burst into flame. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, Mrs. Finley's little boy can't stay in here. I got to get out. Mm-hmm. So I took off my helmet and took off my shoulder harness and so on with dinghy, because you don't need a dinghy. This was over ground. And I got out. But my foot got jammed in the cockpit. And I can remember saying to myself, my God, I can't die this way. Mm-hmm. Those are the thoughts that went through my mind. To this day, it's just etched in my mind. My God, I can't die this way. Mm-hmm. And whatever I did, I don't know. All I know is that I fought my way, and they say you get a real shot of adrenaline, mm-hmm. and you get superhuman strength or power or something. And so I guess that's what happened, because I suddenly broke clear of the airplane, but I left my flying boot in the airplane. So here am I at 300 feet. That's all the altitude I had, about 300 feet. And I finally got out, and I pulled the ripcord open the parachute. The parachute opened, just popped open, and I hit the ground at the same time.
Oh, so you just made it.
Just made it. I mean... Oh. Split seconds earlier, and I would have been killed.
How long were you by yourself before you...
Well, as it turned out, as soon as I landed in my parachute, I suddenly heard voices shouting and dogs barking and whistles blowing and all that, a lot of noise. And I looked over and I saw this horde of people coming towards me. Mm-hmm. They had seen this. They'd see me get hit in the air, and they saw me parachute, and they were after me. This was on May the 2nd, and the war was to end. I didn't know that, but the war was to end 3 days later. Mm-hmm. So it was that close to the end. And so when these people came crowding over towards me to capture me, I just turned and took off and ran. And I was in a field, and I went up a hill, and they started firing at me with their rifles, and I could hear those shots zinging by my ear and hitting in the dust beside me and all that. And it was a very dicey situation. And anyway, I got up the top of this hill, and then when I got over the crest of the hill and started down the other side, I was out of the line of fire. They couldn't see me. They were still coming after me, but they couldn't see me to fire at me anymore. And I got into, luckily there was a great big wooded area, and I got into this wooded area, and I ran as far as I could until I just was ready to throw up, because I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And I think a certain amount of stress, the whole thing. So I just flopped into the ground and covered myself up with leaves. It was in May of 45, and I covered myself over to camouflage myself as best I could. And then I heard them come into the woods, and the dogs were barking, and I thought, well, those buggers are going to get me. because I thought if they had a good tracking dog, he'd get me right away. Mm. But fortunately for me, they couldn't have been well trained for tracking because they never found me. Mm. So I just lay low until, this was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when this happened, and I lay there until 9 o'clock at night when it got good and dark. And then I decided I had to get the hell out of there because they'd be back the next day looking for me. Mm. So I walked, and I must have walked 20 miles that night. Yeah. I figured roughly 20 miles. And I had a sense of direction because I could see artillery fire off on the horizon. And I knew that the Germans and the British and the Canadians and the Americans were all having an artillery duel out there. Mm-hmm. You could see the flashes on the horizon. So that gave me a target to go to. And I did that, and I walked through the night, and then the next morning I hid out because I didn't want to be visible. I hid out in bushes and that sort of thing. And then in the afternoon I heard a bunch of engines firing up, and it turned out to be a German motorized unit that was down in this village. And they suddenly left the village, and they were going out in a northeasterly direction to get away from the German, the British, and the Canadians coming in. And that's when I jumped out on the road because a tank came down the road. And I was afraid at first to jump out because I thought the tank operators would think they were going to be attacked by a German soldier with a grenade or something like that. And so I avoided jumping out too soon. But when I did jump out, the tank would just roll by me, and there was a little staff car right behind. And the staff car jammed on their brakes and rolled down their windows and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm a Canadian." And I explained that I'd been shot down. And they said, "Well, there's no room in here," because the thing was full of equipment and so on. So they said, "We'll call a tank ahead, and you run and get on the tank." So that's what I did, and that's the way I got back.
You rode on top of the tank?
Yeah, I rode on the top of the tank till they could take me back to a safe area. So that was my second one.
And was that the end of the war for you there?
Well, it was, because I got picked up by one of our Austers, which is a little single-engine communication plane. They picked me up from another airport and took me over to my base, which was just southwest of Hamburg in Germany. And they flew me back. That was on May the 2nd is the day that I was shot down. May the 3rd was when I was getting back. May the 4th, I was back with my squadron. And the next day, May the 5th, the war ended. So I didn't have to go back into combat again.
How long were you in England before you got shipped back home after the war?
Oh, well, I stayed on in the Army of Occupation until September of 45. And then they flew me home from Hamburg. They flew me to England. They flew me from England back to Canada, to Montreal. And I was able to register in McGill University the next day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you finished your studies there?
Yeah.
From your first mission to your last mission, were there improvements in equipment in that 3-year span?
Yes. The Spitfire ended up with 22 different models, starting back from the very time that the first Spitfire went into the air. There were 22 different versions of the Spitfire, improvements each time. Change of an engine, change of the wing structure or whatever. There were a number of things that made the Spitfire a better aircraft in the latter part of the war. I flew the Spitfire 21, which was the second newest Spitfire. I flew that. I was sent up to the test pilot school at Boscombe Down in England, and I joined what they call the Intensive Flying Development Unit, and it was to test the Spit 21 to see how it would work out in combat. And I had the pleasure of flying that airplane and put quite a bit of put close to 100 hours on it, which is quite a bit. But it was a great airplane, the Spit 21.
So there's a vast improvement from the first vast, one to the last one.
Yeah. So you wouldn't know they were the same airplane.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They looked a lot alike. They didn't change the profile of it an awful lot, but it was a better airplane.
Still a technical.
Stronger engine, a more powerful engine, and that sort of thing.
Of all the dogfights that you were involved in, what differed from the first one to the last one in your experience?
Well, I guess I got a little more experience from the long time I'd been on operations. I did two tours of operations, and the first tour that I did, I started in, 43? I guess it was, I keep losing track of time. I think it was 1943, and I finished my last tour May the 5th, of course, in 45. But, I learned a lot. I mean, you get confidence if you survive. you get more and more confidence as time goes on. You think that you're the best fighter pilot in the world. And maybe you are. Who knows? But, there are a lot of damn good fighter pilots. I don't know where I'd rate myself. I had a lot of experience. I flew the 190, the Falkhof 190. At the end of the war, Stocky Edwards, who lives up here at Comox, he was our wing commander. And at the end of the war, he commandeered the Falkhof 190. There was a fighter base somewhere around where we were, and he went over there and he talked them into letting him have this airplane. Well, what could they say? I mean, they were defeated. And
yeah.
So they said, yes, go ahead, sir. So Stocky Edwards commandeered this 190, and I was a squadron commander and he was the wing commander, one rank above. And he called me in one day and he said, Hart, he said, I want you to take a Spitfire up, and he said, I'm going to take that 190 up. He said, I want to have a dogfight with you and see how we make out. So I said, fine, great. So we went up and we went through this thing. I got on his tail from the initial break that we had, and he tried to shake me off, and he couldn't.
So this was the Spitfire 21?
No, this is the Falkhof 190.
No, the one you were flying?
No, he was flying the 190.
And you were in the...
I was flying just a regular Spitfire.
Okay.
Yeah, Spit 9, I guess we were. So, he tried like hell to shake me, and he couldn't. So we laughed about it, and we got down on the ground, and he said, well, look, he said, you take the 190 up, and I'll take a Spit up, and we'll try it again. And I said, okay. Well, the different result was that... he got on my tail, and I couldn't shake him.
Oh, really?
I was flying the 190. Mm-hmm. He was flying a Spitfire. So it was just to see...
the differences.
Now, mind you, there are differences in pilots, how well they can execute maneuvers. Some pilots are held a lot better than others. Mm-hmm. And I don't know... I don't think I could have put a finger on a guy and said, he's definitely the best fighter pilot. There are a lot of good fighter pilots.
Mm-hmm. You rose to become a squadron leader while you were in the Air Force. What made you rise above the rest of that position? Like, what was it, your experience? Or?
I guess my experience and my record. I had shot down 6 German aircraft and I'd won the DFC, and I guess they figured that that I was the right guy to put in as a flight commander, a squadron commander.
What was it being like a squadron commander? Like,
gave you a big responsibility.
Did they treat you differently? Like, did your men treat you differently once you were promoted?
Well, if you were a good fighter pilot and you were well-deserved in your rank, your boys would usually go to bat for you and speak nicely about you. I didn't have any trouble. I mean, I think I was popular, but perhaps just because I was one of the boys, and I didn't strut around like a peacock hen or something like that. I did just what I was expected to do.
Because the year's winding, that you do have some freedom from command, because if you're out fighting, they can't give you every order to do. What was it always like you, the possibility of knowing that you were personally sending someone to their death? Not personally, but because you're their leader. And if you sent them out to a mission, it was potentially they could die from that mission.
Yeah.
Did that affect you at all? Or?
Well, you're always conscious of that. You're conscious of the risks that were involved. When we were on the ground at our fighter base, we'd be called in to the briefing tent. If we were under campus all this time. We were living in tents all the time that we were in Normandy and so on, up until we got into Germany. Once we got on the move, then we had better accommodation. We didn't have to use tents all the time, because often we'd land on a German base that had been, they'd taken off and got lost. And we'd have nice buildings, like messes and accommodations and that sort of thing that the Germans had. So that was a different time. But in Normandy, we were under canvas all the time. And that had its good and its bad points. It was very dusty and very dirty. It was tough living. But we just got along very well as pilots. You know, there was no... If anybody ever stepped out of line, they'd thump down on them.
And
he'd smarten up, or he'd be sent off somewhere. But when you went into the briefings, and you saw what we were going to be doing, like low-level strafing, attacking tanks and armored vehicles and all that sort of thing, we realized the risks that were involved. And you just start getting butterflies in your stomach. You know, you'd get nervous. As you're going out to your airplane, you're nervous as hell. But once you get in the airplane and you strap yourself in and you start getting organized to get started and take off, that leaves you. And you know that you've got a job to do. So you don't let those sort of things hold you back.
Of all like the Germans that you fought in dogfights and say the bomb missions that you escorted, do you ever think back now and from now, like of those people that died during those missions?
Oh yeah, I have vivid memories of buddies of mine who bought the farm, you know, who were shot down and they just didn't get out. One fella in particular, by the name of Hudson, he was a buddy of mine, not as close a buddy as some of the others, but he was a good friend. And he had to bail out on one occasion. This was over Holland, I think it was. No, not Holland, Belgium. And he tried to get out by what we call bunting. Bunting is where your aircraft's in flight and you go down on a slight dive, just a slight dive, pick up your speed, and then you pull the nose up and you come up, and just as you reach, as the speed starts to drop off, you slam the control column forward. And that pitches you out. It's almost like an ejection seat. And I had used that on my first occasion when I bailed out of the channel. I used that bump technique. There are different ways of getting out of the airplane, but that was one that I felt was the surest one. Because if you execute it properly, there's a hell of a force there. The force just blows you right out of the cockpit. Well, Johnny Hudson, on his occasion, he was going to bunt. But he bunted, but he didn't do it quite well enough. His speed was off. And he got pitched back against the cooptop, this thing that slides over you, canopy. and he got pitched back onto that, and he couldn't get it. He couldn't get free, and his airplane just went into a dive, and he went in with it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was hard to take because we visually saw him going down and crashing, mm-hmm. and knew that that was the end of Charlie Hudson.
So was there that separation if you saw when your buddies go down and just hearing, like when you got back to base and seeing someone?
Oh, yeah. You feel it. You feel it. I mean, if you're human, you're bound to worry about it and worry about him. Feel sorry, but that was the war, and we had to accept those risks, and accept those feelings.
Knowing what you know now, say from your start of your training when you joined the Air Force up even to 2005 now, if you could go back knowing what you know, would you do it all over again?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I can't see any reason why I wouldn't. If I believed in it in those days, I don't think my thoughts have changed on it. I think I still feel an obligation, or I don't know whether it's an obligation, but it's something that you have to work out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the guts to do it, or you haven't got the guts to do it. And I know that a lot of people couldn't join up because they were too afraid. Well, what can you do with it?
Mm-hmm. So, obviously the war is a huge part of your life. Is that something you think of as every day goes by?
No, I don't think much about it. Unless I have an occasion where I might go out to an Air Force mess and meet up with some old buddies and we'll refight the war.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty common. But I had a much, much more interesting career after the war than I did during the war.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into this because it's pretty prolonged, but I was chief executive pilot for the Department of Transport in Canada, and I flew all the VIPs around, the prime ministers and the foreign dignitaries, royalty. I flew the Queen and Philip, and I flew President Johnson of the United States, and that sort of thing. And I had a very interesting background on my civil side, but they're two different things.
Mm-hmm.
One is...
So you're trying to get too nostalgic about the war and
yep.
try to live in the present rather than always think
exactly,
about
it. Yeah.
Just a question out of interest. You see all these movies today, like... there's the movie Pearl Harbor, Saving Private Ryan, the miniseries Band of Brothers, that portray the war. Like, have you ever seen any of those?
Oh, the odd one, but they're kind of corny.
Yeah, so you don't think they're accurate at all? It's just more interesting.
Well,
than...
they're fairly accurate. I don't know. I can't comment too much on it. I don't go out of my way to watch those sort of things. I know what the real thing's like, and I don't think anything on the screen today is going to change my feelings or my mind about what I went through.
Mm-hmm. So if there was a movie being made, what would you like to see portrayed in it? Or would you even care at all, or would you want it to be portrayed as accurately as possible?
Well, I don't like to see the gruesome side of it. I don't like to see slaughter or really gruesome situations that sometimes they put on the screen. I don't know whether there's a need for that or not. I mean, it's pretty gut-wrenching for a lot of people. I guess if I'd lost a brother, I had two brothers. One was in the Navy, the other was in the Army, and they both survived the war. My brother was hit by flak, and he had got a pretty bad head wound, but he survived. I don't know.
Personally, for me, I'd rather see more of the camaraderie side of the war.
Well, that's what I'd like to see. Yeah. the fun that we had. I mean, it was a lot of fun. You know, you were bound to have lots of fun. You had to keep active. So you had things to do. You played billiards or pool or track and field stuff. I can remember in Germany, we had a big track and field day where guys got out and had foot races and long jumps and high jumps and all the rest, you know, just for the fun of it. We tried to keep active and keep physically fit. That was important for us. And when we were in Germany, in the Army of Occupation, we were at a place called Uetersen, which is in the north of Hamburg, and they had all the facilities on that base. Uetersen was one of the best of the German bases, much like Trenton is the main base for the RCAF. I mean, that's where all the action is, Trenton. And Uetersen was the same way in Germany. So we took over that base, and that's where we operated from in the Army of Occupation.
And you had leisure time there as well, you played games?
Yeah.
Would you ever include the German soldiers at all?
No. We steered clear of that. We didn't communicate with them any more than we had to. Something.